From Quality Radio Productions, it's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell with another hour of sounds from the Golden Age of Radio. Getting the hour underway with an episode of Maxwell House Coffee Time. This was a summer replacement series for the Burns and Allen show in 1947, starring actress and singer Frances Langford. This is program number 8 in the series, originally airing on NBC July 24th of 1947, performing Macbeth for the Women's Club.
Good evening, friends. This is Frances Langford bringing you a part of the American scene, Maxwell House Coffee Time. May we come in?
It's Maxwell House Coffee Time, brought to you each week by Maxwell House, the coffee that's bought and enjoyed by more people than any other brand of coffee in the world at any price. So have another cup of coffee and listen to 30 minutes of words and music and reminiscence. This week, the voice of Eloise, the Maxwell House Orchestra and Choir under the baton of Carmen Dragon, bring you the music of Jerome Kern. This is Toby Reed, and here is your hostess, Frances Langford.
Makes me dream all day, dreams I know can never be true. Seems as though I'll ever be blue. Who means my happiness? Who would I answer yes to? Well, you ought to guess who. No one but you.
That was only sensational, Frances, only sensational.
Well, thank you, Toby. Jerome Kern wrote it, and you can't do any better than the Kern song.
And Marilyn Miller introduced it, didn't she?
She certainly did, in Sunny. And there's another song of hers that's a favorite of mine, too, from the Kern musical, Sally.
Look for the Silver Lining?
Exactly. And if you don't mind, Toby, I'd like to sing it.
Mind, I'll sit right here at your feet and listen.
Look for the silver lining whene'er a cloud appears in the blue. Remember somewhere the sun is shining, and so
the silver lining. You know, there's nothing very complicated about a melody like this. It could be expressed with a few simple notes. For a brilliant composer like Jerome Kern, the melody is just a beginning. Rich and pleasing harmonies are skillfully blended to bring out the unique qualities of every note. And a simple melody becomes a musical creation that's eternal in its popular appeal. in much the same way, skilled craftsmen create Maxwell House coffee, combining the distinctive flavor qualities of many great Latin American coffees to achieve the rounded perfection of the one unsurpassed Maxwell House blend. Our Maxwell House experts choose Manizales for mellowness. They select Medellins for richness. They add other superb coffees for robust vigor. And they blend in Bucaramangas for fine, full body. And it all adds up to great coffee at its flavor peak. A blend so wonderfully delicious, it's bought and enjoyed by more people than any other brand of coffee in the world. So why not get the best in coffee drinking pleasure? You can for just a fraction of a penny more per cup than the cheapest coffee sold. Just say, Maxwell House, always good to the last drop.
So always look for the silver.
Kern's world was a mighty big world. You know that, Toby?
Well, I know his music has been sung all over the world.
Bet it has. Because like all good music, it speaks an international language. When Jerry Kern sings of a river or a city or of love, you don't have to understand the words to know what he means. For his music is a key to any heart that responds to beauty. Listen as the Maxwell House Choir and Orchestra bring you the haunting melody Jerome Kern called All the Things You Are.
Certainly one of Jerome Kern's best-known scores comes from the magnificent musical Showboat. And here is Francis Langford to sing the unforgettable Can't Help Loving That Man.
Oh, listen, sister, I I can't tell you why. There ain't no reason why I should love that man. It must be something that the angels done planned. Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly. I've gotta love a man till I die. Can't tell loving that man of mine. Tell me he's lazy, tell me he's slow, tell me he's crazy, maybe I know. And tell loving that man.
Might be the play that the women's club puts on about this time of year.
In my opinion, women's clubs are a menace, a nuisance, and a complete bore.
Well, I don't talk that way about your clubs.
My clubs are intelligent, high-minded organizations where men spend their time in intellectual pursuits, like playing poker.
Well, anyhow, I told the women's club you'd be glad to cooperate.
Well, I won't be. This time, you can just go to someone else's father.
But no one else has a father that's as good an actor as you.
Yeah, that's quite right. But I'm not wasting my talents on those old hens in that chicken club. Who's going to direct the ham bake this year?
Jerry.
Jerry Collins?
That's right.
Well, when did he join the women's club?
Don't be silly. He's just directing the play because he did it in high school, and he's familiar with it.
What's the play?
Macbeth.
Who's playing Macbeth?
Jerry.
Jerry Collins?
Uh-huh.
Why, he couldn't make the Fourth Road Company of Penrod.
That's very small of you, Pop.
Well, Jerry's been trying his best to become an idiot all summer. With a little more time, he's going to make it.
You know your father's a cinch, so you leave him staring darkly into his coffee cup, and you go over to trap your next victim. Oh, you'll be wonderful, Carmen. The part was made for you.
You think to yourself, steady, old man, he's turning it on. It's only a step from here to the guillotine. Say no and say it fast.
I was just saying to Pop, I was saying, Carmen will never let us down. Carmen knows how important the women's club is to the town.
You think to yourself, say it, Carmen. Say anything. Say you feel a broken leg coming on.
Please, Carmen.
She gives you a look, you know, the kind that makes you yell, Uncle, and then kill him when he comes. And you hear yourself saying, sure, Francis, I'd love to be in the play.
Well, that takes care of Carmen. And you go after the third marked man. Hello, Toby.
You think to yourself, uh-oh, I've heard those tones before. She's coming, and I'm going to get the worst of it.
Remember when you played Hamlet in high school, Toby?
You were just wonderful.
Well, I didn't exactly play Hamlet, Frances. I carried a spear.
But you carried it so beautifully. And you had such poise and distinction. Toby, the Woman's Club is putting on a play.
Not with me, they aren't.
Oh, Toby.
You think to yourself, I knew it. Here comes the waterworks. You feel like a heel, just the way she wants you to.
I never thought you'd let me down.
Oh, Frances, be fair. I carried your books for you. I cranked your ice cream freezers and beat your fudge. I ran your errands. Why, you had only to back and I carried. But please don't ask me to make a public spectacle of myself.
Very well, Toby. Do you wish to let me down when there's a crisis? That, of course, is your prerogative. But I must say, Carmen was certainly more cooperative. Carmen agreed immediately.
Is that poor man's John Philip Sousa going to be in your play?
Carmen would never turn down a ladies' club in distress.
When's the rehearsal?
And so the next night, your cast arrives for your first rehearsal.
I have all your parts here.
What am I playing, Jerry?
You're the first witch.
I'm the what?
You're the first witch, Mr. Hope.
Do I look like a witch to you, Jerry?
Please don't make me answer that, sir. Mr. Dragon, you're the second witch.
I just remembered, my first violinist has a terribly sick second cousin. I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to excuse me.
Deserter.
I'm a rat, aren't I?
Don't make me answer that.
You wouldn't walk out on me, would you, Carmen?
I wouldn't. I'd never let Frances down, no matter what she asked of me.
Neither would I.
You're the third witch.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, come on now. At least try your parts, please. For the sake of the Woman's Club. For a terrible moment, you think they're all going to leave. But they finally take their parts and the rehearsal begins.
When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won.
What's the hurly-burly?
That's a lot of loose, sharps, and flats, I guess.
Please, kindly stick to your parts. Mr. Reed?
That will be ere the set of sun.
Where the place?
Upon the heath.
There to meet with Macbeth.
It's Macbeth, Mr. Reed, Macbeth.
Well, I was just trying to make it rhyme with heath. Carmen says heath.
You read your own part. Never mind mine.
I have to follow you.
Come on, fellas, read the script, will you? Go on, Pop.
I come, Gray Malkin. What the heck is a Gray Malkin?
That's Mr. Dragon.
I resent that.
Why? The name fits beautifully.
Come on, fellas, it's only a play.
Well, I refuse to be called Gray Malkin.
You just have to be.
Who says so?
William Shakespeare.
Oh, well, in that case, all right.
Will you say your line again, Mr. Hogue?
I come, Gray Malkin.
Paddock calls. Paddock? Paddock is a thing for a horse, a broken-down barn.
Paddock is Mr. Reed's name.
Oh, typecasting.
Why, you...
Hold me, please. Read your line.
Anon.
Best line he's had. Beautiful reading, old man.
Listen, you fat-headed...
Now, everyone reads together.
Double, double, toil and trouble, fire, burn, and cauldron, bubble.
Doesn't that sound a little silly to you, Jerry?
It's William Shakespeare, and Frances wants it.
Oh, well, of course. Then it doesn't matter if it sounds silly.
You spend weeks and weeks rehearsing, and then you start having costume fittings.
If I have to wear skirts, I want ruffles on them.
We have wigs for all three of you, and masks.
Frances, will you do me a favor? Where it says first witch on the program, write anonymous opposite it, will you?
Will you do the same on the third witch, will you?
The programs are already printed. Mr. Dragon, we can't pin your skirts if you keep wiggling.
Why can't I play the part of Macbeth?
You're just better for a witch, Pop.
Remind me to say something nice about you sometime.
Hey, while you're standing here, you might as well go over your lines. Let's try the beginning of the fourth act. Your line, Mr. Hogue.
Thrice the blinded cat hath mewed.
Mr. Hogue, please! Put a little more personality into it. Remember, you're a witch.
Then get me a broomstick and I'll get right out of here.
Let your words come out full and pear-shaped.
Yeah, so round, so firm, so fully pear-shaped.
Come on, Mr. Hogue.
Thrice the blinded cat hath mewed. Does that sound like pears?
foil pears.
Oh, hang the blasted line anyhow. If that won't do, do it yourself.
All right, Mr. Hogg. If that's the best you can do, the woman's club will just have to accept it.
I will never understand why the woman's club had to go outside their own organization to find witches.
Please, try the line again.
Thrice the blinded cat hath mewed.
Thrice and once the hedge pig whined.
Harper cries, tis time.
Double, toil and trouble, fire, burn, and cauldron, bubble.
They're getting better, aren't they?
I don't think Shakespeare would agree with you.
And so the days passed. The ladies canvassed from door to door selling tickets. And on the great night, the high school auditorium is packed to the doors. And the show goes on.
All hail, Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Glamis.
All hail, Macbeth. Hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail, Macbeth. Thou shalt be king hereafter.
Stay, you imperfect speakers. Tell me more. By Sindel's death, I know I'm Thane of Glamis. But how of Cawdor? The Thane of Cawdor lives, a prosperous gentleman. And to be king...
You sit there listening to the old words, written in another country in an earlier century. And you think of all the footlights these words have crossed, in schools, in civic auditoriums, in theaters. And the words have a stirring ring of a great master of drama. And the actors have taken on a kind of magic, and you're proud of them. And you think, the theater is a great part of the American scene, the professional groups and the amateurs. And dramatic words you listen to and remember, and are always ready to hear again.
I go, and it is done. The bell invites me. Hear it not, Duncan, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to hell.
Summer theatricals. The Straw Hat Circuit really is pulling the crowds right now, packing the barns from Pasadena to Skowhegan.
Sure, and there's something else pleasing the people coast to coast these days.
Meaning Maxwell House coffee, hey, Francis? How right you are. Like summer theater and summer fun, Maxwell House is a real part of the American scene, too. Coffee? Well, it's our national drink. And this fact stands out. Today, with over 1,000 coffee brands to choose from, more people buy and enjoy Maxwell House than any other brand of coffee at any price. Explaining this popularity story is flavor, of course. That good to the last drop Maxwell House flavor that comes from the masterful blending of premium Latin American coffees, radiant roasted to perfection. Flavor plus value. For with all this extra flavor, Maxwell House costs but a fraction of a penny more per cup than the cheapest coffee sold. Right now is a good time for iced coffee, and icing is a real test of coffee flavor. And the Maxwell House flavor really stands up. Brings you a hot weather drink that's tops. But hot or iced, be sure you get Maxwell House. Always good to the last drop.
When Victor Herbert died, Jerome Kern became the new Dean of American Music. It was a formal title, but he was far from a formal man. He loved unconventional suits and ties and hats. He loved to tease and play pranks and eat things like kippered herring for breakfast. He was loved, and he loved deeply and fervently. He was a pretty wonderful person. You can say a lot about Jerry Kern, but when you get around to his music, you have to let that speak for itself. Listen while Eloise, the choir, Carmen Dragon, and the orchestra and I bring you some of the music that has made Jerome Kern an immortal part of the American scene.
Along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face, his manly grace. Of the kind that you would find in a statue. Oh, I can't explain. It's really not his brain that makes me thrill. Because he's wonderful. Because he's just my Bill.
Next week at Maxwell House Coffee Time, when Eloise, Carmen Dragon, Toby Reed, the orchestra, the choir, and yours truly will return with some of your favorite songs, another vista of the American scene, and of course some words and music about Maxwell House. Join us then and make your enjoyment doubly complete by listening over your cups of Maxwell House. Always good to the last drop.
Just a taste of Jell-O pudding and leave me, you will know.
You'll know you never tasted anything better. And Jell-O puddings are back at your grocer's right now. Jell-O puddings with that rich, distinctive homemade goodness. Flavor that's best by your own taste test. Mellow and smooth as cream. Jell-O chocolate pudding, Jell-O butterscotch pudding, Jell-O vanilla pudding. They're made with milk and nourishing. They cook in just about 5 minutes. That's Jell-O puddings. You never tasted anything better.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
It's the Upstate Radio Theater. I'm Jake Longwell. If you want to get in touch, it's qualityradioproductions@gmail.com. And our website, qualityradioproductions.blogspot.com. This is show number 1704. We'll conclude the hour with an episode of Sleep No More. This NBC radio series aired in late 1956 and early 1957. A series of bizarre and terrifying short stories, all narrated by Nelson Olmsted. This broadcast was the second to last in the series. It aired on NBC April 17th of 1957, with the stories Homecoming and Aunt Cassie.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Thank you, Ben. The first of our two stories tonight is by Dorothy B. Hughes, one of the outstanding women crime and mystery writers of our country. This is a powerful presentation of what happens to minds which are not always capable of accepting the major frustrations of modern living. It's called Homecoming. It was a dark night, about 6 months after the Korean War. A small wind night, the night in which evil things could happen, might happen. He didn't feel uneasy walking the two dark blocks from the streetcar to her house. The reason he kept peering over his shoulder was because he heard things behind him. The little moans of the wind quivering his own flung shadow, and his own step solid in the night, moving to her house. He'd be there. The hero, Korea Jim. He'd be there since supper. She'd have asked him to supper because this was her folks' night out. Her folks always went out Thursday nights, ladies' night at the club. By now, she and Jim would be sitting on the couch close together and only one lamp on. Too much light hurt her eyes. They were big as cartwheels, blue sometimes, smoky blue, and sometimes sort of purple-gray. Her nose didn't change. It was little and cute as she was. Her mouth changed colors, red like a Jonathan sometimes, sometimes like a holly or mulberries. Her mouth. He picked up his steps, and this time he didn't look over his shoulder. Nothing was back there. And beyond, a block beyond her house, he could see the blur of a green light, the precinct police station. It was somehow reassuring. There couldn't be anything behind you with the police station ahead of you. Besides, he had a gun. It was heavy in his overcoat pocket. On the streetcar, he felt everyone's eyes looking through the pocket and wondering why a nice young fellow was carrying a gun. He could have told them. He could have told them he was going to Nan's house, though she wasn't expecting him, though she'd told him for the 12th night in a row, "I'm so sorry, Benny, but I'm busy tonight." He could have told him he was going to surprise Nan and especially surprise Hero Jim. He'd find out how much of a hero Jim was. He'd see what big, bold Jim would do up against a real gun. She'd see, too. When he'd ring the doorbell, they'd sort of jump apart, wondering who it was. Jim would come to the door. He ought to let Jim have it right then and there, the dirty, cheating, lying, sitting around saying, "I don't want to talk about it, Nan." Waiting to be coaxed. And she had coaxed him, bringing up things about the raid that had been printed in the newspapers along with a picture of Jim. He didn't want to talk about it, but once she got him started, she couldn't stop him. He'd gone on and on, practically crawling around the floor, and then he'd stopped, and the sweat had broken out all over his red face. She didn't say anything, just looked at Jim. And he, Benny, had put a hot record on the phonograph. He'd had enough of Jim showing off. But she just sat there looking at Jim. Benny knew that night what was going to happen. Her and Jim and him out of it. It had always been like that for Jim. He got everything. In high school, he was elected captain of the basketball team. He was a junior class president. He was the one the girls were always looking their eyes out at in the halls. When other guys had pimples, Jim didn't. When other guys had to grease their hair to keep it out of their eyes, Jim's yellow hair was crisp enough to stay where it belonged. When other guys' pants needed pressing and they forgot their dirty fingernails, Jim didn't. Korea Jim. Even in the war, he'd come out the big stuff. It wasn't Benny's fault he'd never been sent over. The Army didn't say, "Would you like to go to Korea and be a hero?" They said you were doing your part just as much in the recruiting office. He thought he'd been lucky until Jim came back with all those pretty ribbons and his picture in the paper. Jim, who'd always had everything, and now this, and Nan, too. Well, he wasn't going to get away with it this time. He wasn't going to have Nan. Nan was Benny's girl, and had been for almost 2 years. Jim hadn't meant anything to her those years. Just one of the gang in Korea. And Jim wasn't going to come back and bust up Benny and Nan. He could get plenty of other girls. Just because he'd been Nan's fellow in high school before the war didn't mean he could walk back in and take over, not after leaving her for 2 years. None of that mattered now at all. There was only one thing counting. Nan, his girl, Benny's girl. Jim was going to find that out tonight. He was there at the white cement steps, the familiar steps. He climbed the steps without breaking the firmness of a stride, without trying to be quiet. He wasn't afraid of Jim. He pushed the buzzer once, hard and firm and not afraid, like he'd been pushing it for 2 years since he ran into Nan at a USO party. It happened the way he knew it was going to, a wait, while she and Jim jumped apart and she smoothed their hair, wondering who it could possibly be. And then the footsteps of a man coming to the door. Benny's hand gripped tight on the gun in his pocket. Holding tight that way kept his stomach from jumping around. The door opened suddenly before he was quite ready for it to open. And Jim was standing there, tall and lanky in the dim hallway, peering out to see who was standing outside. Not expecting Benny, not expecting him at all, because his face came over with a real surprised look as he said, "Well, for Lord's sakes, it's Benny." Benny didn't say anything. He stepped in, and Jim had to stand aside and let him pass. Nan was standing near the archway. He didn't say anything to her either. He simply stood with his hands in his overcoat pockets looking at her. He didn't even take off his hat. He couldn't, not without letting her see how his hands were shaking. Nan started talking the minute he came in. She was mad. Her eyes were like sparklers, and her words came out of her mouth like little spits of lead. His hand was so tight on the gun that his fingers ached like his heart. He wanted to cry, to bawl like a kid. But he wouldn't, not with Jim standing there like he owned the parlor, like he was head of the house, waiting to see what this peddler wanted. And Nan was saying, "What are you doing here, Benny? You know very well I was busy tonight. I told you that. Now, what's the idea of coming here when I told you I was busy? And at this time of night..." He had a feeling she'd been saying it over and over again. He wanted to laugh at her, to laugh and laugh until he doubled up from laughing. But he just stood there listening to her until Jim said, "Shush, Nan." He said it sharp, like he was giving orders to a soldier. Benny looked at Jim then. The way Jim had said it, you'd have thought he was nervous. Like he knew why Benny had come and that he didn't want to have it happen to be shown up in front of Nan. And Jim said,
Why don't you take off your things and join us, Benny? We're just sitting around waiting for Nan's folks to get home from the club. Come on, Benny. We'll have some jive. I brought Nan some new records tonight. Swell new Basie. Have you heard it?"
Shaming him because he never brought any records to Nan. Jim didn't stop talking. He kept coaxing him like Benny was a little kid, asking him to have a soda with him, just like Benny was still a high school kid instead of a man. Hero Jim, the plaster saint, acting like he never had a slug of gin, trying to make her think he was a Galahad and Benny a no-good bum.
"Why, I was just telling Nan, we hadn't seen you for a long time. Wondered what had happened to you. Why you didn't come around."
"Yeah, sure. Rubbing salt in the wounds. Acting like he and Nan were married. Trying to show Benny up for an outsider." Nan stopped Jim, a hard, icy crust of anger around her soft red mouth. "What do you want, Benny? If you have anything to say, say it and get out. If you haven't, get out." Her voice was like a whip. And Jim said,
"Oh, you shouldn't have said that, Nan. Benny's come to see you."
"I told him I wouldn't see him tonight. He knew I was busy tonight. I'll tell him now to his face what I told you. I don't ever want to see you again. Now get out!
Nan!
Jim's voice wasn't steady. He twisted some kind of a smile at Benny. Come on, Benny. Sit down. Let's talk everything over. Now, Nan didn't mean it. We're all friends. We've been friends for years. Now, sit down and have a soda. Benny brought his hand out of his pocket then. He had a smile on his face, too, but it hurt his mouth. He had a little trouble getting his hand out of his pocket and holding onto that thing at the same time, but it came out, and the gun was still in his hand. Jim saw it, and he had sweat on his upper lip and above his eyebrows. He was yellow, just like Benny had known he'd be. Korea Jim, Hero Jim, was scared to death. Jim's voice didn't sound scared. It was quiet and calm and easy.
Well, now, where'd you get that, Benny? Let me see it, will you?
Benny didn't say anything. He just held the gun. Sweat trickled down Jim's nose. He laughed, but it wasn't a good laugh.
Well, what do you want with a gun, Benny? Might hurt somebody if you aren't careful with it. Come on, let me see it.
He'd had enough. Hero Jim standing there like a dope, like he'd never seen a gun before. Now was Benny's time to laugh, but the gun made too much noise. Nobody could have heard him laughing with all that noise. Even if Nan hadn't started screaming, standing there, her eyes crazy, her face like an old woman's, just screaming and screaming and screaming. He only turned the gun on her to make her keep quiet. He didn't mean that she should fall down and spread on the floor like Jim. They looked silly, the two of them, like big sawdust dolls, crumpled there in the rug, scared to death, scared even to look at him. That's the way a hero acted when a real guy came around, like a soft, silly girl lying down on his face, not moving a muscle, lying on his face like a dog. The room was so quiet, he could hear the beat of his heart. Oh, he'd had enough of their wallowing, of their being scared. He said,
"Get up. You look crazy lying there. Get up."
Suddenly he shouted,
"Get up."
Then louder,
"Get up! Get up!"
Scared to death, scared to death. The gun made such a little noise dropping to the rug, his fingers couldn't hold it. They couldn't get up. They could never get up. He hadn't meant to do it. He wouldn't hurt Nan, not for anything in the world. He loved her. She was his girl. He wouldn't kill anyone. He hadn't. They were doing this to get even with him. He began to shout again, "Get up! Get up!" But his voice didn't sound like his own voice. It was shaky like his mouth and his hands and the wet back of his neck. He started over to take hold of Jim and make him stop acting like he was dead. He started one step, and that was all. Because he knew that whatever he said or did couldn't make them move. They were dead. When his mind actually spoke the word, he ran, bolting from out of the house, stumbling off the stoop, down the steps to the curb, and there he retched. When he was through, he was too weak to stand. There were lights in most of the houses. You'd think the neighbors would have heard all that noise, would have come running out to see what was going on. Well, they probably thought it was the radio. If they'd come, they'd have stopped him. He didn't want to kill anyone. Even Jim, just scare him off. Oh, Nan couldn't be dead. She couldn't be. He sobbed the words into the wind, in the dark, in the dead brown leaves. He sat there a long, long time. When he stood up, his face was wet. He rubbed his eyes, but the rain came into them again, spilling down his cheeks, filling up, overflowing, refilling. He ought to go back and close the door. The house would get cold with it standing wide open, but he couldn't go back, not even for his gun. He started down the street, not knowing where he was going, not seeing anything but the wet, dark world. He no longer feared the sound and the shadow behind him. There was no terror as bad as the hurt in his head and his heart. As he moved on without direction, he saw through the mist the pinpricks of green light in the night. The police station. He knew then where he was going, where he must go. The tears ran down his cheeks into his mouth. They tasted like blood.
Powerful story indeed. And now, Nelson, what's the second story like?
Quite different, Ben. This one is a lighthearted and, to me at least, delightful fantasy by Virginia Swain called Aunt Cassie. It was odd, Edward Alden thought, as he struggled with his dress tie, how one little old lady, really very kind and well-intentioned, could so rub a whole family the wrong way. All this, too, in front of a guest. That the guest was only that nincompoop boy, John Nesbitt, whom Eileen thought she was in love with, made it worse, not better. In front of Johnny, Mary had called Aunt Cassie an old dodo, and Eileen a hysterical little fool. And he, Edward, had shouted at them both to keep quiet, and when they wouldn't, he'd rushed out of the room and slammed the door. Only Aunt Cassie had behaved like a perfect lady. She had come teetering on her dainty feet into the room where Eileen was entertaining Johnny and said in the careful diction acquired in 1875 at the Oxford Female Seminary, "Eileen, dear, your great-uncle Horace is standing behind you there. He wants to tell you that in our family, young ladies never sit up after 10 o'clock with young gentlemen to whom they're not engaged." Eileen had given one blank look and then begun to cry, and her parents had come running. Mary, with a horrified look at Eileen, sobbing and crumpled on the sofa, had made a lot of unintelligible clucking sounds, shot a glance of pure hatred at Johnny Nesbitt, and turned to Edward in a way that showed she meant him to deal with this, Aunt Cassie being his aunt, not hers. Aunt Cassie caught her look and turned to Edward, too. She said, "Well, you understand, Eddie, it's not my opinion, only Uncle Horace's. He's been trying for days to tell Eileen, but I met him in the linen closet yesterday, and he said that since you were all too stubborn to see or to hear him, I'd better tell her. He said, 'Tell that girl. That's not the way to catch a husband.'" Her voice was sweet and low, and she smiled with innocent affection upon them all. It was then that Mary had called her an old dodo, and Eileen had stopped whimpering and begun bawling, and he had yelled at them all and gone out and slammed the door. He could recall how Johnny had sat like an ugly gingerbread man in his brown suit, bolt upright, at his end of the couch. He was still annoyed with Eileen. It was embarrassing for the kid, of course, but she had been trained for 12 years in the proper way to deal with this crotchet of Aunt Cassie's. And she should have risen to the emergency last night. When Aunt Cassie came to live with him, Eileen was 6, and they'd explained everything to her. If Aunt Cassie spoke to someone who wasn't there, she was only dreaming and you ignored it. If Aunt Cassie pointed out to you someone that you couldn't see yourself, you said yes, politely, and remembered that old ladies live a great deal in the past, and sometimes it makes them happier to pretend that persons who are gone are still around them. Eileen had accepted it like a good little sport, and together the three of them had weathered 12 years of Aunt Cassie. She was a decent old girl in every other way. She mended all their clothes and made spiced pickles and jellies and kept herself attractive with nice old lace and rather coquettish dresses of gray and lavender. She had her own money. Not much, but enough to pay her own way. Yes, he had to admit, pushing his starched shirt flat and watching it buckle out again, she paid a little more than her own way. If she weren't helping with the household bills, he couldn't have afforded to buy that second-hand car for Eileen's graduation present last June. Also, her doing the sewing gave Mary more time for her club work. But he acquitted himself of any mercenary motive for having Aunt Cassie in his house. He was fond of her, and she had done a good deal for him when he was young. But by heaven, if she was going to upset Mary and Eileen... Oh, now, suddenly, his anger veered around. Eileen needed a good talking to. Oh, she was a nice girl, but Mary spoiled her rotten. She had no sense of responsibility, no gratitude. She'd been downright unpleasant tonight about his taking her car, which he himself had given her as a graduation present. He was going to take it regardless. With his own car in the shop and this insurance banquet 20 miles away, there was nothing else for him to do. When he'd given up trying to keep his shirt front flat and had brushed his hair for the 5th time over his bald spot, he walked across to the chest of drawers and pulled out a whiskey bottle from under a pile of shirts. He took a good long pull at it. Then he filled a flat silver flask and put it in his hip pocket and put the bottle back in the drawer. When he went down to the dining room, the three women were standing there waiting for him. Mary, rather quiet and shamefaced, came across and hunched his dinner jacket up in the back over his collar. and patted him. Eileen looked sulky. She cast a young, disdainful eye over his gala costume and said, "You be careful of those brakes, Dad. The car shouldn't be driven that far until they're fixed. There's ice all the way to New Canaan, and they haven't sanded it yet."
"I'll be careful,"
he said, looking at the decanters in the sideboard. It was going to be a cool drive, and if he took a little shot from one of those, he'd have his flask intact for the evening. He let Mary help him on with his coat and hand him his gloves. He stiffened his knees, and somehow that made his shirt front pop. But he walked masterfully to the sideboard and poured himself a drink. Aunt Cassie said, "My goodness, there's Betsy." There was silence for a moment, except for the noise Edward made in swallowing his whiskey suddenly. "Must seem funny to you, Neddy, to hear your mother called Betsy. I know that Yankee preacher she married always called her Elizabeth, but down home she was Betsy." She turned slightly away from him toward the doorway. "Yes, Betsy? What is it?" Again there was silence. But in the silence, the three of them, Mary, Eileen, and Edward, turned against their wills to face the door. After 12 years, you'd think they'd stop doing that. Aunt Cassie was nodding her head and then shaking it. "Oh, yes, Betsy, I know. He's drinking too much spirits. It's bad for his blood pressure. He ought to let the stuff alone when he's going to drive a car." She paused. "Yes, yes, I know you died before automobiles became common. Nowadays, the police will arrest you if they catch you driving when you're drinking. Betsy, have you seen much of Mother lately?" Edward set the glass down on the edge of the chest so that it tottered and fell off, spilling a few drops of whiskey on Mary's prized oriental rug. He glanced at her and saw that she looked angry, but whether with him or with Aunt Cassie, he couldn't judge. He seized his gloves again and went out in a hurry. He had to check his pace in the front steps because they were slippery. Road wasn't so terribly slick. Once out of town, he stepped harder on the gas and said to himself that there was no danger so long as he didn't have to use his brakes suddenly, and he wouldn't have to, for there was nobody else on the road. He'd just have time to make his appointment if he got up speed. He began to hum to himself. He took a back road north of Darien, which cut 4 miles off the trip. People avoided it because it was narrow, and one point crawled for some distance along an edge of a ravine. That made him laugh. He knew that road like a book. He felt good and warm inside and competent. His headlights cut a brave swath in front of him. Going was wonderful. Smooth as glass where the ice covered the ruts he had met there the last time. He was going to get to his banquet on time. The lights that cut across him from the curve ahead blinded him completely. The roadster jerked and waltzed and skittered and dropped into space. Later, when he pulled himself out from under Eileen's wrecked car, his first thought was to notify the state police. Well, that guy hadn't even stopped. He made his way back home. He was dry enough, at least he felt dry, perhaps because his clothes were frozen. Even his shirt stopped popping and stood out like a balloon in front of him. During the last mile, when he was really beginning to feel somewhat light and giddy, he steadied himself by thinking, "Oh, Eileen will have a fit seeing me coming in looking like this." But he was so glad when he turned into a street and saw his home that he forgot the ruined roadster in the gorge, the criminal carelessness of the fellow who had pinned those sons on his fender, even the lurking suspicion that if he had not taken those 2 big slugs of whiskey and an empty stomach, he could have checked the crazy dancing of the flipper. He climbed the steps, went into the house. The hall and front parlor were dark. The women used the back parlor after dinner, Mary busy at her needlepoint, Eileen poking a tune out of the piano, Aunt Cassie darning socks or reading beside the gas fire. He tried to shrug off his outer coat, but it wouldn't leave him. When he reached to take off his hat, he remembered that it was icebound somewhere in a hollow between Darien and New Canaan. He struck numb, stiff fingers against his shirt front and saw that they made no impression on it. All right, then. He'd go back into the back parlor as is. Wait till they heard what had happened to him. He'd have to buy Eileen another car, only fair when he had ruined hers. As he went through the front parlor, he thought of last night and Johnny Nesbitt and wondered why he'd let it perturb him. There was nothing to worry about. Mary loved him. Eileen loved him. 2 delightful women who made up his life. From behind the double doors, he heard conversation. Eileen said, "Oh, it was mean of him to take my car tonight. He knows Johnny and I always go to the movies on Saturday night. And then Mary said rather feebly, he thought, well, he did have to go to that dinner. Edward took a step forward and stood in the wide doorway. The women were at the other end of the long room. For a moment, he thought Eileen had seen him, but she couldn't have because she dropped her eyes calmly again to her hands lying listlessly in her lap. There was only one lamp burning in the room beside Mary's chair. He felt deflated because nobody had looked up and cried out with horror at his battered appearance. He crept into the shadowy end of the room and sat down close to the dull glow of the grate. But still they didn't notice him. Eileen was absorbed in her own discontent. She turned back to face her mother and said, why couldn't you have picked me a better father, Mother? You must have been a darn attractive when you were a girl. He turned in agony to look at Mary, but she wasn't looking shocked or angry, only puzzled and a little sad. And she said, well, Eileen, it may surprise you, but he was considered very attractive, too, when he was young. And I couldn't foresee Aunt Cassie, you know. Well, he could bear no more of this. He sprang from his chair and strode toward them into the circle of the lamplight. Mary, he said. Mary, I'm here. I had a wreck, but I got home all right. Nothing happened. Eileen went on pacing up and down, and his wife didn't raise her eyes from her embroidery. There was a light tapping of feet on the hardwood floor outside the parlor door. He knew it was Aunt Cassie, and he was annoyed because he wanted to get this straightened out with Mary and Eileen. Aunt Cassie was just inside the door now, and she said in her bright social manner, well, Liddy, how is it over there? When you see Uncle Horace, tell him to pay me a visit. Was there anything particular you want me to tell Mary and Eileen?
You can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it? Tonight we have heard Nelson Olmsted telling two stories, Homecoming by Dorothy B. Hughes and Aunt Cassie by Virginia Swain. What can we expect next week, Nelson?
Two stories, Ben, which are quite different. Zona Gale's rather wistful story of a man with a frightening imagination. It's entitled Evening. The next is by H.G. Wells, entitled The Flowering of the Strange Orchid. And believe me, it is strange. Join us if you're up to it.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Daniel Sutter. Mr. Olmsted's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
I'm Jake Longwell. The Upstate Radio Theater is distributed by Quality Radio Productions.